We had flagons of port or something up the back of the bus on our school excursion to the snow. Remember that one?
Nice. All right. Well, hello, Peter. How are you?
Good boy. Thank you for asking.
And welcome to the super fun, awesome, happy time pedal show podcast. It's a mouthful, I know, but it's...
Yes.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
And thanks for having us at your place. Yes. So Peter Coppers, out of the church. So for people that don't necessarily know, sort of tell us about your background, sort of your music. How did you start getting into music? What sort of inspired you to pick up an instrument?
An organ, probably a Hammond organ was the instrument.
Okay.
It was on loan. Well, not on loan. It was just in my father's house.
Okay.
He was in a band and his keyboard player was moving house, so it didn't have anywhere for it, so he left it at our place for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And I wasn't interested in the guitars or the vibraphone in the house.
Vibraphone, that's cool.
There was a vibraphone there. So, but this Hammond organ just, you know, really, you know, I responded to it. And I didn't know how to play keyboards or anything like that, but I just loved the sound of it, especially the Leslie thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I know maybe I had some good experiences in church or something as a kid that I don't remember.
Okay.
Because that was, you know, a musical influence, obviously.
Okay, okay.
And I've since thought about it that school teachers who used to play piano in class and that style of piano...
Mm-hmm.
Is how I try and play piano now too.
Okay.
And I even teach that style of piano, that the way the Beatles were taught that kind of piano, I think.
Okay.
About learning to read music, because all their fingering is totally wrong, and I teach terrible fingering habits, which are very practical and songwriting approaches to music. As a teacher, I always teach everyone. I said, well, I'm going to teach you the songwriting perspective of music and playing guitar, playing bass, or whatever, from the songwriting perspective, which is the most important anyway. So I had the keyboard.
Is not right or wrong, really.
Yeah, so the keyboard was there, the Hammond organ, which my father said, well, you've obviously got an interest in music, but I can't buy you one of those because they cost as much as a new car.
Yeah.
So what would you like? And I said, I don't know. So he bought a drum kit.
Okay.
And got me lessons from a military drummer who knew all styles, particularly Latin American.
Okay.
Which he forced upon me, and well, not forced upon me, but I realised after a while, you're not playing rock, and I said, you either teach me some rock or I'm going to let you go. And he taught me some rock, which I later realised... the Ringo beat was based on a bossa nova that he'd been teaching me anyway.
Okay.
and then I've since realised that pretty much that's what Ringo Starr does. He plays Latin kind of feels across the parallel of the Beatles.
Okay.
Especially live when you watch them. And so I joined a band at school and overcame the suspicions of people that I wasn't into sport, but somehow when we did a concert, suddenly I had a lot of friends because they realised I wasn't a sports person, I was a music person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they
accepted me because I hung around with the guitarists and that in the band who were into sports, so they kind of, you know, sort of accepted me, but now they kind of understood me. And then I started learning guitar from the guitarist in the band who was a classically trained guitarist.
Okay.
And he also played a bit of piano, so he taught me blues piano.
Okay.
And that was in Canberra. And we just continued that. And then I started playing guitar in another band,
mm-hmm.
just a kick around Santanery style kind of prog rock band that we just jammed, you know. And then we were rehearsing in the same places where Steve Kilby from the church lead singer was rehearsing with his band. He was just a bass player at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they walked in on early for one of their rehearsals and we were still there, and I was a bit embarrassed that our drummer was so terrible, so I got on the drum kit and did drum solo spontaneously for some reason, I don't know why. But they invited me to join their band, but they already had two drummers, mind you, because the reason I was there was because a friend of mine who was a drummer needed a car, and I brought him to the rehearsal to replace their drummer, and they didn't tell that drummer that he was being replaced, but he turned up, so they ended up with two drummers. So they had two drummers, and they were a glam rock band, so that was okay. And I'd have two drummers, but the drummer was so bad, they kicked him out and asked me to join. But the lead singer was gay and had a fancy the drummer that got kicked out, so he left as well.
Okay.
And so Steve had to become the singer. And then I started playing drums with my mate in this band with two drummers, and there's no better feeling than two drummers
to drum
back, you know, kicking it. But these days you have two and three drummers, like Stevie Wonder had four drummers, had two drummers and two percussionists. And I've seen quite a few bands have two drummers.
Well, James Brown, I mean, he was famous for the whole two-drummer thing too.
So we had fun with it. But then Steve sort of started making a move on saying that the guitarist wasn't good enough, so he kicked the guitarist out, and then I took over on guitar.
And then
we thought, well, we should get another guitarist. And there happened to be a guy in Canberra who was like the best guitarist in Canberra, if not Australia.
Okay.
He was also a friend of mine who was who later ended up coming in on bass guitar, actually. He organised a jam at this grammar school in Canberra with these other musicians there, and we met this guy, and we're all jamming together, and my guitarist mate in my band, who was like classically trained guitarist and that was really good playing some rock and roll, and then suddenly this guy started to play Star Spangled Banner. And everyone in the room was just like shocked and just watched him play Star Spangled, because he'd been in Hawaii and actually had seen Jimi Hendrix play.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he was playing left-handed, except his guitar was upside down, because he had a right-handed guitar, so he was playing Star Spangled Banner left-handed on a right-handed guitar with the most beautiful tone. He had P90 pickups in this Gibson.
Yeah.
We all had, you know, Jap copies and that.
Yeah.
And we were just like, you know, shocked. Anyway, he ended up joining the band, church, right?
Okay.
So there's me, the drummer, playing guitar with the best guitarist in Canberra, and he was such a beautiful, affable guy. He shared all of his knowledge of Ritchie Blackmore riffs and Robin Trower and with me. He just, you know, he was a beautiful person, you know, to not be jealous, and we have no rivalry whatsoever.
Oh, cool.
And we just bloomed, you know, and my guitar bloomed, my guitar playing. And and then the whole time I was trying to make my guitar sound like a Hammond organ. And I didn't hate bar chords, because you had to hold down so many strings. And I knew how efficient they were, because I actually learnt them on a 12-string acoustic guitar. Knowing the economy of playing bar chords, it would be a lot easier to move them. But then I realised they really hurt. So I did everything to avoid them after that. So I started droning stuff, and then I realised, you know, any three-piece musician like Hendrix or Jimmy Page and that know that if you've got droning strings, you can change chords and it fills the gaps of the stuff. So I progressed with that, and with, funny enough, it had a sound like The Church, you know, with the chorus pedals that suddenly became available at the same time in the 80s. And then, but it still wasn't a real sound until like 1988. I plugged into a Leslie cabinet with my guitar for the Gold Afternoon Fix album, and then lo and behold, there was the sound, you know, that I'd been looking for, and perfectly matched with my droning guitar chords. And so I had to invent all my own guitar chords, you know, to have droning strings together you know. So that's how the style originated. And in doing that, I actually discovered something in the first band that I was with, you know, as a guitarist. We did chiming fifths, piled fifths on chord progressions.
Yeah.
And that had a harmonic synergy.
Okay.
And I realised then what I was going to be looking for. I didn't know at the time, but I've been looking for that in everything I ever did.
Okay.
In fact, and
so how do you go about doing the fifths? Like, would both play different things to build a chord?
This is the other thing, is the basis of The Church and everything like that, that I've noticed pretty much jazz, you know, four-note chords are two chords played at the same time anyway.
Sure.
We did the Opera House just recently with an orchestra, and the orchestrator said to me, he said, how come you and Marty are playing different chords on that song Tantalized in the chorus? Like, he's playing an F and you're playing a C, and then you play a G and then he's playing the C. What's going on there? I said, that's pretty much what happens.
What you guys are doing.
The jazz guys, you can combine every single note as long as you keep them an octave apart.
Yeah.
Any notes.
Yeah, it gives them some together. Space. Yeah.
And that's and Bert Bacharach, people like that.
Yeah.
They have this technical capacity. They put sixths and ninths on the bottom of their bass chords and that. So recently I've been, you know, compiling a guitar scales book, because the application of this idea is a bit foreign to anyone, because you can tell them, like, Hendrix used every single note in Red House, you know, on the fretboard. But it's not coherent unless you have some structures for it. But that's what the jazz guys do, you know. They play every single note. Yep. So you don't write that scale down, because it's just like a black page. and I actually, George Goller was a jazz musician in Galapagos Duck, and he came to Canberra and was giving tutorials. And another friend of mine who was really into jazz chords and writing that kind of style of music, folk jazz, if you like, he booked a lesson. He said, why don't you come along? So I went along, and he didn't teach us any guitar. He just taught us the science of modes.
Okay.
In the 1, 3, 5 notes of each chord, and the chordal progression, but also the sevenths, which are pretty significant. Adding that to it.
Okay.
And that just astounded me. And then for Almost With You, the song that I'm kind of recognised for a significant guitar solo, that had several key changes in it, and I had to identify the chord progression and its root key, and then play the scale of the root key over that chord progression or that section of the song.
Okay.
And we edited it together, but I had to use scales to do that, you know, that scales knowledge to do it. And I've always had that application behind everything I did, even when we were breaking all the rules or rules were being broken, I always apply it in reference to that science, which is pretty much the black and white notes on a keyboard.
You know why you're breaking it. Like,
I do
why
know.
You're breaking those rules.
I do know.
That's what... Well, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the point,
You know the rules before you break them, and why you're breaking them, how...
No.
And that, the effect that is coming out of that.
Yeah, it's like always a case of why not. And you're going to make new music, you know. We're on the frontier of inner space, I call it, you know. We've got... It's a science. We're hardwired. When we hear seventh chord, it's a signpost back to the first chord of the progression. And so it's fascinating. And I'm sure John Lennon and all those writers have a holistic view of the science of music, as much as, like, waiting for the inspiration to dawn on them that a song appears in them. They're asking questions and noodling around and mechanically. And out of that is when you get your results, you know, of songs. So that's pretty much the short answer.
The short
answer. Why I ended up where I am now, and we never have writer's block in the church. We can't. Yeah, every time we record an album, there's 3 albums worth of material.
Okay. Wow.
Cool.
And you're just in the midst of almost finishing one album now?
Yeah, we've done pretty much picked the songs and got the backing tracks and overdubs. Primarily, and vocals are being just comped at the moment.
Okay.
And one song's been mixed and being released this week.
Okay, okay. Oh, cool. So then, later this year, early next year, the album?
No, the album has to come out very soon.
Oh, soon, okay. Yeah. Oh, wow, okay, very good. Very interesting. And you're off to America soon, too, for a tour?
Yeah, in a couple of weeks. They had a festival there. Booked a festival in Milwaukee some of this, so that we thought, let's just do a few dates around it, because festivals are really important to reach people, more people than
of course,
more fan base, you know,
because you've all these people that aren't necessarily there to see you and then they might that's always,
and they see your name on a poster and that. But the problem is, the name the church hasn't got much bearing for many people anywhere in the world, even though they know the song Under the Milky Way, and in Australia they know Unguarded Moment. They don't know that the name of the band is the church. So when you go and advertise yourself playing somewhere and they see the church, they either think you're religious nuts or not very important. So that's always been, and we've never wanted to really sell ourselves out to try and champion ourselves on the basis of our hit songs as well, mm-hmm. because we're an album band as well. We're a musician's band, and the musicians all know about us, you know.
Mm. You see, so in live, there's a lot of improvising going on with you guys. There's a lot of jamming, is there? Or is it?
We can do. We could do jamming festivals, which are big in America, you know. They just go and jam. Because we've had things like that. Particularly a song called Magician Amongst the Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a jam song that went mm-hmm. for 15 minutes, you know, at the end of the night.
Okay.
And we jam out the middle of some songs, like you took's a prog rock song from 1982, one of ours, that style.
Mm-hmm.
And we jam out the middle of that. Pretty much it's my opportunity to do a guitar solo and expose all of the scales I know.
Okay.
And modes. And
all in one.
I pretty much do. I do. I run them all together because I'm exploring. For me, it's like I take off into space and go exploring every night something that I might not have, you know, explored the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all pretty much within that pentatonic shape and adding notes within that shape that kind of and then I get bored with that and I'll go get chromatic too sometimes, you know, just I think anyone's onto me, you know, I'll go and change it, you know. But it seems to be pretty fascinating for people, but it's very psychedelic in the true sense of the word, of like mind expanding through the messing with the science that we're, as I said, hardwired to. Technically, we hear a minor chord, we feel sad, hear a major chord, we feel happy. But there's three modes of major and three modes of minor, and then you've got the blues ones, which the classical people calls an abomination. I love using those and chucking those in there, and if that's not enough, I'll go and put a flat fifth in there, and then I'll even go do the Hendrix thing and or jazz thing and go and mess with that. So I'm not bored every night doing a solo, and the audience doesn't seem to be bored either.
No, and I mean that makes it interesting. It's exploring things that aren't necessarily, you know, common.
And the hardest thing is to avoid the cliche.
Yeah, well, that's it.
So I don't bend any notes in that, pretty much.
Okay. Because I remember seeing, was it last year? Was it the year before? You guys did a live internet stream, like a concert live, and was it like a South by Southwest or something like that?
Yeah, that was one.
Was it last year?
We've done a few radio ones in Seattle, and we've done. Yeah, but yeah, that was South by Southwest.
I just remember it was a live video, and I was watching it because that was around the time I was when I was teaching for you here.
Yeah,
and I went, oh, okay, I've got to watch it. And I, just from memory, I just remember it being very. It seemed like a very free jamming sort of environment. Mm-hmm. A lot of the songs, you know, as in, it's very open for all the musicians to kind of do.
Actually, it might appear like that, but it's not.
Okay,
because we are a guitar band.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happens is there's orchestrations, and there's quite specific orchestration. There's a little bit of, you know, freedom within there, but pretty much there's very set structures.
Okay.
For verses, choruses, middle eights, and it's there's a lot of interaction between the guitar playing. That's particularly what our trick is.
Yeah.
That makes us different. I hardly ever strum chords, for instance. You know, it's all an embroidery of sounds and that.
Yeah, because there's sometimes up to three guitars. It's like acoustic and two electrics. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've got a keyboard player and guitarist and...
An
auxiliary keyboard guitarist. He's an excellent musician, and he has to be, you know, to play the guitar parts that Ian and I don't play. He has to be up there. He's actually a guitar teacher as well.
Okay. There's a few of us around.
Actually, his main job now is one of the most successful producers, you know, and owns one of... He works out of EMI Studios, the original EMI Studios in Sydney. So,
oh, wow.
So he just comes out on the road for a lark, you know.
That's nice. That's great.
Mm.
So when it comes to gear...
Yeah.
We were just talking earlier on about you just got a Strum Blue Sky to sort of or Big Sky, not Blue Sky, Big Sky.
I thought you said Strum a Blue Sky.
No, Strum and the Big Sky.
Strum and Big Sky.
It's
a B side on something.
To basically to instead of having two big rack units and sort of stuff like
three.
That, or three big rack units. So when it comes to equipment and gear, what sort of gear, what is it that you look for in gear? And do you,
well,
a lot of times
look... two lines.
Okay.
I've got the analog line and I've got the special effects line.
Yeah.
And in the analog line, I've got two amps. I run stereo with, I think it came from, I always like the Vox, which is a mid-rangey sound with no yeah. top and bottom, but they, it's an, I don't know if it's A-class amplification, but they technically, my father's an electronics whiz, and he built my first Vox, actually.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so we just got the transformers and the circuit diagrams that were coming with the 1975 reissues.
Okay.
Which my, the other guitarist bought one, so he gave me the circuit diagram, so we just
okay. that one as well. That's handy.
And I had Marshall speakers in it,
yeah.
left over from a... a quad box that I used to build for my Marshall, which I got rid of because it didn't sound like a Marshall, you know, things
okay.
like that. You know, the tone,
yeah.
things, you know. Actually, the other guitarist, he was a guitar whiz, and he used to build these microphone volume boosters, you know, and low
okay.
impedance transformers, and he'd jam them into his amp.
Oh, wow, okay.
Play into our amps and overdrove. They didn't have, they had fuzz boxes a little bit. Actually, I've got one there I found just recently.
Okay.
built me for me, though. I never really liked them. I mean, I thought, I don't like fuzz boxes. And then many years later, I realised that Hendrix's whole sound was a fuzz box.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get a Hendrix sound that was a fuzz box.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so he used, we used to overdrive the amp. In the end, what I used to also do is photos online of me with an Electronics Australia Playmaster amp that my father built, 15-watt stereo. And I used to, we used to have the whole band plugged in that originally.
Oh, wow, okay.
You know, the bass player and the two guitarists, and I think the microphone. It had four inputs.
Oh, wow, okay.
It was a stereo 15-watt amp, so it had a little bit of separation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what everyone did in the 60s, right? So this amplifier... I jammed that into the front of my Marshall, the output.
Oh, wow, okay.
The output of that Playmaster 15-watt straight into the input of my Marshall.
Wow.
And I, the guy from Sensational Alex Harvey Band apparently did the same thing to
okay.
his tone.
Wow.
And where Richie Blackmore used a tape recorder output,
yeah.
jammed that straight into his Marshall.
Yeah.
And that was his sound.
Double preamps.
Yeah.
Well, then that's where all the tape echoes and stuff, people used to, they used to use them as a preamp running into the...
Well, that's what he tried. He had it was a tape echo.
Yeah.
He used this tape, two-track tape machine as a tape echo, and then he just stopped using the tape and just used it to drive his amps.
Yeah.
Jimmy Page did that, yeah. Lots of people did that just to get that extra... Yeah, no, that's it. That's very interesting.
Tone. So that's how it all started, that interest in getting the tone kind of thing. And then it just you just go on from there. So then they came out with overdrive pedals. We used to just use our Vox full volume and pretty much turn down for rhythm and turn up for lead, you know. And and then they had overdrive pedal. I don't know. I still think that's the best sound, that turn your amp up and turn it down. Like I realised probably they used to have their amps down around 2 when they were clean, like Hendrix and that, because they had such sustain on clean tones.
Mm.
And then they turned up full volume... and they just compress, because that's what I discovered with having a Blackstar or a Marshall switchable amp next to the Vox in the stereo analog line, that the echoes would be really last a longer time coming out of the dirty amp because they were compressed.
Mm.
The echo would go dark, 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 dark. I said, what's wrong with my echo machine? And the Vox would go dark, dark, dark. And it was because the amps were so highly driven, high gain. That they compress. So, and that's why I use both of them together, so I can play a nice clean sound, enjoy the clean sound of the Vox and the Blackstar's really dirtying it up and compressing it and probably feeding it back. So the Vox is probably feeding back because the amp's feeding back.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the tricks I used to use in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
With
okay.
Hendrix, you know, his engineer used to take a line out of his guitar straight into the desk. And Hendrix would be out in the studio with his Marshall on full volume. And he'd hardly even record that, maybe in the room. And add that to the, he won't really tell you what he does.
No.
Hendrix's engineer, but...
So, Eddie Kramer?
Eddie Kramer, yeah.
That's up here. Mm. So, is this the Blackstar you use?
Yeah, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's that one.
So, is it quite Marshall-y?
Yeah. They're made by Marshall engineers. They mutinied from Marshall and went out on their own.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But... I know it's, I've got a sponsorship deal with them, and so I shouldn't really say anything bad. But the only amp I like that they really like that they do is the HT Studio 20.
Okay,
is, and I don't know what the difference is between that, but I really like that.
Okay, cool.
And I like marshals, you know. Well, I like some marshals. Most marshals are rotten, you know. But
there's sort of a bit of hit-miss,
yeah, I find. Yeah, I've got a combo marshal that's got Vox output valves in it, which they made, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
I think it was DSL 40, with, and I just really loved it. I said, why is this sound so good? And I realised it had Vox output valves in it. So it was like a cross between a Marshall and a Vox.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember what the model Chris's Marshall was?
Oh, jeez.
It's a 70s thing, wasn't it?
It was a 70s thing.
It was like their answer to the Twin.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's only like this deep, but it's dual 12 combo. And it's a gorgeous clean tone.
Fantastic sounding.
Yeah. And the reverb is beautiful
too. I don't remember what it was.
I've never seen one before.
Mm-hmm. You come to realise there's like, three amp styles. There's three amp styles, I reckon, primarily the Vox, which is A-class amplification. As I realised when my father built it, they don't have a negative feedback, which is a thing that balances out the output by putting the output, the unbalanced, the stuff that the output valves can't take, it sends it back in the input out of phase so that it goes back out the output and cancels it.
Okay.
Voxes don't have that.
Okay.
So they just squash. They just go, too bad. They just try and squash. And their A-class amplification, which is supposed to be really high fidelity because they were originally record player amplifiers.
No.
So they're just squashing this sound and at A-class amplification into the speakers. And whereas the Marshalls were like a really terrible design, apparently. The original Marshall circuitry was really terrible.
Yeah.
And cheap and nasty, and B-class amplification or something.
Hmm.
But they really got a dirty kind of sound. And my father used to try and doctor up my Marshall with, you know, master volumes and everything like that, but I never liked it, you know, until I had this Vox, you know, through the Marshall speakers, and that was what I used on the first few albums until it got stolen. Which probably wasn't a bad thing, because no repairers would ever fix it up, because if someone's homemade amp comes in, they say, I'm not touching that, it's like a bird's nest.
Yeah. A small fire on my hands.
Yeah, so that, how well it's a, especially nowadays with the, you know, limited liability and
issues. Oh, yeah, everything is, yeah,
but it was the best sound I ever had. And so I've got a 60s Vox now that's just, and they can be hit and miss, man. It's a really tight,
the same, yeah.
It's a very tight Vox. It doesn't, it's not squashy. The 70s ones were very squashy, actually.
Okay. Or,
that.
And so they're always on at the same time, the two amps?
They're pretty much always on at the same time.
Yeah.
So that, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on your sound engineer.
Okay.
Sometimes if they like a rocky thing, they'll go for the dirty one. And if they don't, they'll go for the clean one. And say, I'm not. I've never really been, especially with my special effects, I've been wondering, I should just give the sound guy what I want them to have.
Hmm.
Then when you work in the studio, you know, the sound guys, if they're really good, they can get more colour and variety for the sound. If you get, especially in the studio, I definitely do it in the studio. I feel a lot safer just giving them the clean and the dirty sounds in the studio and the effects separately, because when you go and edit afterwards,
you can blend in as much as you want.
Yeah, you can take the effects and blend them in, but I mean, the tails of the effects aren't going to obscure the edits that you
because
they can change. Yeah, so the other amplification thing that really freaked me out, it's like if you plug into a twin reverb and you've got the tones off, you think your amp's broken because they're like volume controls for the tone.
I found this out just recently.
Yeah.
Because is it, if you have them up to 10, it's actually like, it's like a passive volume, so it's actually open?
They just, if you don't have the bass and middle and treble on, no, nothing comes out.
Nothing comes out.
Yeah, I think it's like a, you know, pull tech, like the passive EQ. So you're actually, as you,
if it's all the way up, it's actually bypassing flat, basically.
Yeah,
so right. you're just reducing stuff.
Yeah.
Now getting back to the Vox, they've got a cut and a bass and a tone, a bass and treble, which don't make any sense whatsoever because of that. That's something to do with the negative feedback or something. But when I have to try a new amp on tour and that, they give us, you know, we hire amps and that.
Yeah.
And they get one. I turn the Vox up on about 8, even though I only use them on about 2 live anyway. Turn it up on 8 and just screw around with those tone controls until it doesn't kind of interfere with each other.
Okay.
The bass and the treble, they interfere.
Okay.
And you get internal feedbacks almost and things like that. I always put the cut, the presence down on hardly anything, just enough presence, and then I go and screw around with those bass and tone things until I hear that Vox tone that I know is there. Yeah. And then I take the volume down and I know that the amp's set.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I've never had much experience with Vox. That's, I need to, I need to try
a few, but yeah, I think it's...
They're bizarre.
I need to...
Really bizarre amplifier.
Like all that stuff, there's they have their quirks, and you know, you make the quirks work for you.
we were buying them all up in America, and actually the Bob Dylan and Tom Petty's guitar roadie was working with us on our first tour over there.
Okay, cool.
He had a white Vox and a black Vox, really good ones, and we couldn't afford to keep them, so he took them and gave them to Tom Petty's guitarist, who uses both of them.
Oh, okay.
And then he started, and then Bob Dylan and all those guys wanted them, so he started buying up all of the Voxes around, and he couldn't get the top boosts, or the separate top and bottom cabinet things didn't sound the same. We had a whole truckload of those too, and they just never worked. They were always broken or didn't sound very good. So he started getting the non-top boost. I probably shouldn't say this because it's going to undermine my capacity as well, and he'll probably be annoyed that I tell you this too. But they used to have prototype ones, and you put this... You could buy the tone controls and wire it into them.
Okay.
And Marty used to use those ones. And he said you can just get a Boss graphic equalizer and get the same effect.
Same effect.
Oh, really?
So it's probably easier than messing with the tone controls.
Don't tell anyone, people. Don't tell anyone.
Between us three and the internet.
Us three and the internet, that's it. Don't tell people, internet.
There's a lot in it, really, isn't there? How long have we been going?
We've been going for 30 minutes.
30 minutes, because I talk to engineers, and you know, I know the electronic side and the, you know, the organic side of a lot of this stuff, you know. And
we all work
for the tone, aren't we?
Well, that's it. That's it.
That's your analog line. Do you have pedals in front of the amps or effects?
I've got pretty much two of everything. Okay. You've got modulation.
Yep.
You've got overdrive, and you've got echo, reverb.
Sure.
Dimension. So I've got. I used to use the CS Chorus, and then I had Leslie's and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a rotary pedal, which gives me the chorus kind of effect without sounding chorusy, because chorusy is so old-fashioned now. But so I just wanted to have that Leslie effect. My roadies, I had two Leslie's. I had a stack of Leslie's, you know, two of them on the road.
Wow.
I had like a Vox and two Leslie's. One each side.
They would love you for lugging that around.
I made a deal with them, and I had a Roland 120 for the effects, right? So that was the most glorious sound to stand.
Oh, I can imagine.
Because you know Leslie's, you need two Leslie's because the horns kind of like phase with each other. Instead of whooshing, they go whoosh, 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 they go whoosh, 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 like a thing, you know. So you need two really mic'd up to get the sound.
Yeah.
And of course, the roadies hate me. I said, okay, I'll make a deal with you. If you, because they're furniture, they've got polish. These, they have them as furniture in a rich household.
No.
So I had these really nice Leslie's, and I said, if you bubble wrap them, I won't make you road case them and carry road cases as well, because they're heavy enough without the road case. So they said, sure. And at the end of the tour, they were scratched. But they still sound all right. And it didn't really matter because you used to face them out anyway.
Yeah,
The wall-facing side was faced out anyway.
Yeah.
I think Jan Ackerman had six or eight of them on stage when he was playing with Focus, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm not the only person. Yeah. And then you hear that song Badge, you know, by Cream. He was playing through a little bit. And you hear the Beatles, they were playing pianos and singing and everything through Leslie's. That was their modulator in those days. So I gave up on the Leslie cabinets and got this rotary pedal because, you know, miking up Leslie's is stupid anyway because there's so much sound coming from everywhere and they're only 40-watt amplifiers and they hardly put out any level. Which is strange because they have these KT88 valves in them that I had. My first amplifier, the amp was a Wasp 200 watt, and it had two KT88, and they were getting 200 watts out of that, and they only get 40 watts out of a Leslie. Oh, you know a bit about technical stuff too, do you?
No, a little bit, but I know they're still used for guitar amps,
KT88.
That's
about
as well.
And some bass too, Richard Blackmore had four KT88s in his 400 watt Marshall. 400 watt.
400, well, it's only It was slightly overkill.
It's so loud. Those women's clothes off. It's hilarious.
Anyway, so they bias them different for levers and things like that. Anyway, so I've got this rotary pedal, and I use a flanger as well.
Okay.
Because they're analog flanger. Because I think it's a Boss flanger. I'm pretty sure they're an analog version though. Because
the Pebble ones. I think they're analog.
Yeah. Because they came out, they had digital delays at the time, so I'm not sure.
But actually, wrote digital delay on the front.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if it is an analog or a digital flanger. Actually,
I think they're analog. Actually, still, I think.
Yeah. What I realise is that the rack stuff. The reason I put the racks through, the effects through a separate amplifier, is because the racks don't have that impedance input that Boss pedals and that have.
Yeah. Because they're buffered. That's the whole thing.
I didn't like the echo. Tape echoes along and tape echoes and all that. I didn't like them. They were squashy. You had to set the input. A Maestro Echoplex and a CE Chorus, which had to balance the input on that too, but somehow it distorted nicely.
Yeah.
And so now all these Big Skies and all those, the reason they're working is because they're rack kind of quality with high impedance guitar capacity. Yeah. You know? So I'm kind of thinking maybe I can get back to maybe putting everything through the same amplifier instead of having like a compressor going into the rack gear.
So even a wet dry thing, just say you're still splitting your...
So I don't know if I want to give the sound guys any choice. Like, I don't even have an effects amplifier anymore. I've got a DI.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah,
oh, okay.
A bass DI.
Good with quality.
You know, to give it some tone so it sounds like an amplifier.
Oh, so that all goes direct.
That now it does. Oh, and it comes into my monitor as well, because that was killing people too, because that you get so much power. You have a big clean amp for your effects, and then when I use an Evo especially...
It'd
kill people in the front row, you know. Yeah. I really hate playing small stages and having amps pointed at the audience and that. So we dropped our volumes right down and used in-ears for a while because our lead singer was losing his hearing.
Okay.
And so we got used to playing really low volume anyway.
Yeah.
And I keep... You know, I've still got my hearing pretty intact anyway because I kept away from drummers and didn't have my amps up very loud anyway. But I think it's terrible that people trust musicians and stand in front of their amps. You know, it's a
horrible. You don't trust musicians.
I don't trust the sound. I've been at concerts and the sound engineers are blowing people's heads off.
Yeah, I never understand that. Why? It doesn't have to be that loud.
I used to do live sound, and then I used to mix an Australian band that performed with all of the biggest Australian bands. And we were doing like... I used to watch the sound engineers of the, you know, Midnight Oil guy, you know, he was there and he said, yeah, watch this, I turn up this frequency and the people in front of that bin will throw up, you know.
Lovely.
I think it's good to have a hobby.
Yes.
If the guys on the left throw up, guys on the right throw up.
Get a war going. The mosh pit's getting awfully messy.
Nice, very nice.
So what's in your effects line? So you got Big Sky.
I started with a reverb unit, you know, in the effects line, and I didn't really like reverbs in... I don't know why. Well, it's an effect unit. The record company gave us some money to buy some stuff, so I bought a reverb unit, and I still use the same thing because it became integral to one album. I just went through all the patches and used so many of them, and they're so unique as a Roland Depth 5, and I can't replicate those with anything else. So one of the funniest things is the reverse reverb on anything, right?
Mm.
Or the reverse setting in any pedal. Mm-hmm. I've got a Line 6 with a reverse pedal. I can't get that sound on anything else, although I think something might have just come out recently that could replicate that sound. So I'm stuck with this big, heavy Line 6 pedal, which is pretty bad. It always drops programs, and it's...
Yeah.
But there's something...
The green one.
And I'm stuck with that, using up all that real estate on my pedal board just because of the reverb.
The one sound on it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, go on.
Oh, I watched an interview with Michael Thompson, the Session LA guy.
Uh-huh.
And he said he still has a Eventide H3000 for one patch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it's there.
And it's one of those things, it's like that patch with that guitar with that pedal or something is what has that combination to get atmospheric.
Well, the thing is, rhythms. You think analog, you had Germanium transistors and that in the old pedals that they can't replicate now. You'd think that might be something, but when it gets to digital, that's just like the virtual world. Why couldn't you get... I can't believe that all these digital rack systems can have such different sounds. You thought, well, you've got the same parameters. Why can't you get the same sound out of it?
Well, I actually just watched. There's a guy. What is he called? Junkie XL. He does soundtracks, Hollywood soundtracks and stuff. But it's mostly electronic stuff. Yeah. And he was going through. He has his old samplers that he uses, which are digital samplers, rack samplers. Mm-hmm. But he goes, no other samplers sound like that. It's digital, but for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. He has these four different ones, and he goes, well, this one sounds like that, this one sounds like that. Mm-hmm. And you can have all this stuff on the computers now that emulates it, but it just doesn't sound the same.
Well, I know a little bit more about that, because that's another thing, quantum, you know, digital electronics. It's like we're getting in nerd land here, really, aren't we?
Cause no, but that's well, welcome to our world.
Well, you know, we're sound geeks in the end, you know, and that's our job.
Yeah.
So you've got Pro Tools algorithm for creating a digital tone.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they use mic pres and things like that anyway, but within the programs, they still have algorithm.
Yeah.
You know the word.
Yeah.
Algorithms to deal with the waveforms within the programs as well.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Apple version, which is
Logic.
And then you got Cubase, which were the original people who's the Germans started the whole thing. And I still use Cubase, and they've all got their related sound, film sound things, because those guys, they're more into sound than what we are, because they, you've got Nuendo, which is the sound program for Cubase, and you've got Final Cut Pro is one of the other ones, or something like that, and for the other.
Yeah.
But supposedly Nuendo very proudly say that they've got the best algorithm for sounds and stuff.
Okay.
And I use it all the time. I don't have any complaints, but I don't hear what some engineers hear either, you know?
Yeah, well, that's it, yeah.
But what I know, it does affect, people can hear and are affected by it, you know?
That's the thing with, like, digital conversion from A to D and D to A with recording. Getting off topic, but
that's what we're all going. Yeah. Whether we're going to go virtual anyway,
I think it was the guys from Radar that build the radar systems said everyone uses the same converters. It's all the stuff around it that makes changes the sound, like the quality of the components going in and out of the signal chain, and the stuff that actually gets your analog to the digital conversion.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
That's interesting. Well, I know Apogee are regarded as the best converters, analog digital converters, and I read up a thing on them, and they were so clean they had to introduce distortion
because it's too pristine.
It's so clean that when the sound algorithm stopped processing the sound, you'd get a click. So they had to bring up
the noise
a threshold of noise above the point where the click would happen, so you didn't hear the click.
Yeah.
How
that's bizarre.
Oh no, we're too good.
It's getting too good. Yeah, that's a problem.
I've got another theory that I've offered this to any digital engineer, if they used it, to give me royalty on it. That it started with there's a show, Arthur C. Clarke. You know, fractals, right?
Yeah.
The whole, you know, the concept of fractals is that they have got the two-dimensional formula of the universe.
Yeah.
They can get a picture that's got pixels, and recreate the missing informations with that fractal formula.
Yeah.
The Mandelbrot set.
Yeah.
So that's a two-dimensional formula.
Yeah.
Music's two-dimensional as well.
Yeah.
You know, positive and minus sine waves.
Yeah, yeah.
So I suspect that fractal could also be used for digital waveforms to recreate the missing information to make it back to a continuous wave, which is analog, rather than the digital wave, which is samples.
Oh, okay.
So anybody out there, it's copyright here on this podcast, because I don't...
Patent pending.
Mandelbrot set applied to digital electronics, like it could be bigger than Dolby.
Wow.
I want my share.
Could be the copper system.
Come on, you reckon I could sell more records? That's all I care about. It's not the money. Actually, if we're going to go round and round and touch on everything, it comes down to it. It's just the pursuit of the art, isn't it?
Yeah,
that makes us do all of this, really.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so
money.
Up to my echoes. I've got two echoes. I have an analog delay and a digital delay.
Okay.
And reverbs. I've got a spring reverb in my Black Star. And a cathedral digital reverb in my Vox.
Okay.
Maestro. I was going to get Maestro, not Maestro, but Electro-Harmonix. I was a bit upset with it because it's a stereo pedal, but I couldn't get it to send the echo out both channels of stereo, so I've had to stick it in a separate line as a mono.
Right.
So I've got different reverbs on my Blackstar and different reverbs on my Vox.
Oh, okay.
And I'll use them full on for one particular song. It's like a surf kind of song. Then there's the other thing. Apart from the compressors, I probably only have one compressor really, which I'd never really used that much, but I'm using more now. If the amps are up there, you don't use it much, but I'm using it more now. Tremolos.
Yep.
I've got one tremolo on my Blackstar, and it goes to the Vox, and I've got another tremolo on my Vox, so the two work together.
Oh.
And it sounds like in this song that's our big ending, Miami, our big ending song, where they start pulling the stage apart and there's nothing left, just the drummer with a tambourine, the keyboard player with an acoustic guitar, and me and Ian playing with pedals, and half our amps are gone and all the guitars disappear behind us, you know. And this tremolo effect, it sounds like the amps breaking up and it's gone horribly wrong. Two tremolos running at the same time.
Out of sync.
Yeah, slightly out of sync.
Oh, okay.
It happened as an accident because Aaron, our friend, my guitar tech up the road there, and I were trying to match a new tremolo to my old speed.
Yep.
And we realised the effect of having two of them together because we tried to sync them and they were just slightly out of sync. So, well, there's an idea.
Okay. That's interesting. That's something I will try out now.
Actually, I want to have a chat to him because I've hung out with him a few times, so I'll ask him about that.
We might, we'll go and talk because he builds amps and stuff too, so we should have a chat to him.
Yeah, he does everything.
Right? So something to look forward to, guys. Yeah, internet. Well,
have you played many of his amps?
I borrowed his Dumble equivalent the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Ian asked me to bring one down to the studio in Brisbane, studio, for him to hear it as well. He's got various ones and he tweaks them for different things as well.
Mm.
And it was, this whole clean thing, I don't know, I'm not the Stevie Ray Vaughan clean kind of sounding thing, you know, because I don't know how, it must be just the volume or something. It
wasn't that clean really anyway.
Yeah, but...
It's always in the end.
Yeah, so they I do really like a great clean tone, but...
Mm.
So maybe that's my new thing, is to figure out what that's all about, because I want to go more into Fender amplifiers as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's probably two points. The Dumble thing, he always built them for customers anyway.
Mm.
So it's...
Dumble
apparently specifically tuned them for...
Each customer. Well, that's what he does now. Yeah.
He was the king of eccentric people, because
he
wouldn't... If you would approach him and say, can you build an amp for me, he would probably not do it.
Mm.
He would have to approach you and say, you are worthy.
Well, if it's a $100,000 amplifier, you know.
Yeah.
He probably approaches people that have got $100,000.
Well, yeah, I mean, but he heard these stories about how, you know, some musicians just, you know, they want it. Because I don't think he even builds amps anymore. I don't know if he still does it or not.
No, maybe not.
But people used to approach him and he would... You basically have to apply and send like your bio and resume.
Mm-hmm.
Am I good enough to have an amp built by him? Mm-hmm. By him, and it's mostly modified Fenders anyway.
I wouldn't be a member of a club that would have me as a like that kind of.
I wouldn't trust a club that I'm a member of. but they were kind of hired up Fenders.
Hired up Fenders,
based on the Fender.
And then he did this. Yeah, then he was the original Gooper, where he put that goop over all the circuit board, so you couldn't copy it.
Ah.
Like they made it with the clone pedals as well.
Aaron's worked it out.
Again, don't tell anyone internet.
Don't tell Aaron's.
Maybe the goop is part of the sound.
That could be, but well, you never know. That's it. That's
the other joke, isn't it?
If there's tiny little bits of like iron filings in it.
Well, I did wax my favourite guitar, and this is something I probably really shouldn't tell anybody, and I didn't for a long time, because it's a slab neck telly 59,
Ooh.
And it sounds exactly like Jimmy Page's. and it was painted red all over, and it had, except for the pickup, was a bit microphonic, so they waxed the pickup. But I really thought it was Jimmy Page's until I saw a picture of his, and I saw the wood grain was different than his.
Wow.
And that, you know, the story of his, it was stolen, right? But he couldn't tell the difference between that Tele, 59 Tele, slab neck Tele, and the 59 patent applied for pickup Les Paul that Joe Walsh made him buy off him.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
wow. Well. Because, yeah, his number one, that's, yeah, used to be Joe Walsh's old guitar, the, the Les Paul.
He made Jimmy Page buy it off him. But then, hasn't Jimmy Page changed the pickups, or those ones that he's using now, not the original one with those?
Not sure. I think maybe the bridge. He changed. I don't know if he changed the neck, but the bridge I think he changed. Because he has all that weird, I don't know, many different pickup combinations, because he has the out of phase switches and all four knobs push and pull. And
well, do you know Ben McGregor?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I used to play in the band with Ben.
I did.
I played drums.
All right.
Hmm. Okay, well, there you go.
I was in that band. I was in Show Pony for about 3 gigs, I think, and then disbanded. But he did that wiring to one of his Les Pauls.
Yeah.
The Jimmy Page wiring. Yeah.
And there's, just by, because he did it himself, there's one setting that cuts out the guitar.
It what?
It cuts out the guitar. You get no signal at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Just so there's out of four, phase or something?
I don't know. It's just a combination of no wires met up or something with the four push pulls. And So to do it legitimately, well, you have to have a setting that makes no sense.
I have my push pull. If we're going to go nerd land, I've got my push pull Fender.
With
the center button that
creates the thing.
I just can't decide which guitar to stick it on, you know. But I'm thinking I'm going to stick it on my studio guitar, because that way you can do the bridge and the neck pickups together.
That's what that is. Yeah. It's called an S1 or something.
I already sound too close. I've already tried not to play like Dave Gilmour my whole life, you know, and Carlos Santana and Hendrix, you know, try not to play them my whole life. So I don't know if I should go there or not.
Why not?
So, what guitars do you take out? So you probably got
a... Well, I had a Les Paul. I had a white Les Paul. Hmm. Actually, me and this guitarist in Canberra, we bought two of them. We went up to Sydney and my father knew the guy in the music shop there, so we bought two white gold custom Les Pauls. And they had ebony fretboards and they were fretless wonders. And they sounded like shit. And the frets were so low because they were jazz guitars. And the ebony fretboard, you couldn't bend notes on them.
Yeah, right.
You got the... my mate, Dave Scotland's his name. If you want to meet him and talk to him, he's the luthier at Tarumara Music in Sydney.
Okay.
And he just swapped his for a Strat. And then I did the same thing a few years later. I just, you know... But probably less than that. You know, just swapped it for a Strat. Got rid of my Marshall. Got a Vox. Mm-hmm. Got rid of the Les Paul. Got a Fender, and which I thought I'd never like because it had single pole pickups. But then again, I loved Hendrix, so I couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. But I was listening to Hendrix as a drummer. You know, because I loved the drummer.
Sure,
you know? So I got infected by Hendrix through the drumming. You know, Mitch Mitchell. Mm. But I don't know why I thought. You know, I had an SG was my first Gibson. First good guitar, you know, humbucking pickups. Mm. Now I'm on single pole pickups, and I've got the P90 330 Gibson because I bought one after at this Dave Scotland's tone just blew me away. I just bought one, and now I've got a Gretsch humbucking pickup because I just don't. The only Gibson pickups I really liked that I know about were those 70s SGs. The ones where the pickups were screwed on the body, and I think that the early Gibson SGs, which were Les Pauls, had the same thing. When the pickups are screwed on the body, I don't know if that's the difference, or that they just coincidentally had better pickups. But I had this 67 SG, and my mate, the guy that went to the George Goller thing with me, he had like a 70s Gibson with those horrendous Bigsby whammy bars.
They're horrible.
Just the most ridiculous thing, except if the strings don't go under the bar, because I've seen people use the other ones on an arch top with no bar on the Bigsby's and they actually work. But the thing with the strings going under the bar, so he had one of those and couldn't touch it, of course.
Yeah.
But his pickups were fantastic. And the guitar was so heavy, I mean, that clunk of, you know, big lump.
So thing, yeah.
Bigsby on the back of the thing is like, There's some crazy things that are in this business, you know. They don't warn you about stuff. They don't warn you that most Marshalls are terrible and most Gibsons are terrible.
Yeah, I'm the same with Gibson stuff. It's either you have to try individual guitar basses.
Yeah.
Well, I read somewhere... oh, God, I can't think of his name now. What was his name? Australian guy.
Sounds like...
Don't I?
Oh, God, I'm
David.
Blanking. No, no, really famous...
What city?
Most yeah, no, most people I know think that I'm crazy.
Oh, yeah, the Brisbane fellow that...
what's his name?
Billy Thorpe.
Billy Thorpe.
Mm.
God.
Who had a Strauss amplifier, and it was so loud. That's the loudest concert I've ever heard, was he played a big, loud Strauss amplifier. But he had a great fuzz box for the solo, and most people think I'm crazy. The solo in that... It's the most beautiful tone, isn't it?
No, but I mean, I've read somewhere he spent weeks and weeks and weeks going through, I don't know how many dozens or hundreds of Les Pauls, because he wanted to retire his main one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many he went through to find one that he actually liked.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Well, my favourite guitar, like, it's so valuable, not just because I like it, but I know that people don't know. Like, I've got all these guitar books. They don't even mention slab neck tellies. I don't know why. Slab neck meaning that that's the first rosewood neck. And they put a whole chunk of rosewood with a flat.
Yeah.
You know, a bit of chunk instead of a layer, a veneer of...
Of rosewood.
If you like, rosewood. And they're called slab neck tellies. Yeah. But the 59 guitars, I've had a lot of 59 guitars. They all have really deep pickups. I don't like trebly pickups, so I really liked it. But I won't take that on the road now. And it's too expensive to even insure for its value.
Yeah.
If it was sold, let alone what's value it should be.
Yeah.
Like if Jimmy Page's guitar, real guitar, was found, how much would that be worth?
Oh, ridiculous. How much? Yeah.
And what do you reckon?
Oh, millions.
I've seen Strats on a wall, you know, for $100,000 in America.
Yeah.
Guitar player. Yeah. Guitar.
Well, and having the name associated with it, that's...
Well, even if the name wasn't associated, if you knew that you had the exact model number next to, like, Jimmy Page's...
Yeah.
Yep.
No.
How much would that be worth?
Yeah. Ridiculous.
That's what I got.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to take... And I love it. And it's the best sound, you know.
Just as valuable, really.
But it hasn't got a whammy bar because it's a telly, you know. And it hasn't got a country player when you play a telly.
You can router it out.
Someone's probably got a spare Floyd Rose hanging around there.
Yeah, yeah. Just
an old Floyd Rose, yeah.
Just do it at home. Don't even get someone professional to do it.
No, I don't need a whammy bar.
Chisel in the case of beer.
You'll be fine.
But getting back to guitars, I had that telly and I had a 59 Strat.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I had my white 70 flat pole Strat.
Okay.
And then I couldn't use it because I had to change the tone controls too severely between the guitars. So I just had that. I used the telly, the 59 guitars, I used them on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one got stolen anyway, which is a bit sad.
Oh.
But I didn't really worry too much at the time because I was not using it. But it was really one of the best sounding guitars. And then everything got terrible, didn't it? Like guitars, that was in the 80s, and guitars were already starting to sound really bad. And then if they went from worse, bad to worse, by sticking medium jumbo frets on guitars. They even got a new Hendrix reissue with medium jumbo frets. He would never play medium jumbo frets, I'm sure. Like, if it's not good enough for Hendrix, you know, I mean, why wouldn't... There's not... And I lament this to Fender. I've got a sponsorship with them. I keep telling him, when are you going to go and make a guitar with vintage frets? So I had to go and buy a Mexican Strat, you know, to get vintage frets, a Mexican reissue, because either that or it was like a custom shop, which was
ridiculous money.
You know, so, or buy, at the time, you know, had to buy vintage guitars. And the Japanese were inflating the prices of those because they were buying all the vintage guitars, so you had to pay like $5,000 for a vintage Strat.
Yeah.
Whereas you could buy an American Standard for $600. I got the price sticker. I bought one for $700, $699. They gave me a discount.
Yeah.
and I started using that medium jumbo frets, American standard, and I used to throw it around. I actually broke the body, and they
get
body. Yeah, I just I used to throw it every night. They used to scoot along the floor and hit the guitarist, the bass guitarist, the singer one night, and he was, and then he'd play bass, and it'd be in front of his bass amp, and it'd start vibrating in the streaks. And he started going, "Oh, this is all right." And he could create chord progression. I was like, "Well, backstage now, drinking," and they wouldn't come off stage because he's making my guitar string orchestra make chords by playing the bass because it was in front of his bass amp. So that's when we got reputation for jamming. We all do. So I used to throw that. One night I just took it off and dropped it, and the bridge jumped out of it, you know, and it split the body. So the lesson to you, if you want to throw your guitar,
make it skid.
Don't drop it. Skid like a motorcycle rider coming off, you know. And so they gave me a new body and that. So now I've got three Sunburst Strats. Well, I had three just... Every tie just attracts Sunburst Strats. I bought this Mexican Strat from American Fender, and they only had one left because everything was in NAMM, so they just gave me a Sunburst one and a maple neck. I already had a Sunburst one and a maple neck, and that was going to be my spare one with the vintage frets on it. And then I left that behind one tour recently, and I broke a pickup in my main Strat, so I had to buy another Fender with noiseless pickups in it. And guess what? It was a Sunburst with a maple neck. And it was a vintage hot rod, but it still had medium jumbo frets on it. Oh, no, it drove me mad. I love this old 70s Strat that I've inherited, you know, recently, same era as mine, but hasn't got the pole, separate pole pickups, but it's a maple neck. I really would like to get a rosewood neck one again, but I've got my Tele safe. And then I've got, I bought the Malcolm Young Gretsch, which was the cheapest Gretsch you could get.
Okay.
And it was exactly what I wanted. Double cutaway.
Oh, is it the blonde one?
I got a red one. It had three colours.
Oh, yeah.
And it had the Filtertron pickups, which all the Gretsch snobs don't like. They like the Jimmy Jones or whatever they're called.
TV Jones.
And they all snob these Filtertrons, and this is the best sounding guitar, man. Cool.
I love it.
And it was
cheap.
It was really, really, really the cheapest Gretsch you could get.
Yeah, cool.
And now they don't make them anymore, and they're collector's items.
Score.
It's like 80 Squire stuff.
Yeah. So, and otherwise you had to get the one with the Bigsby on it.
Mm.
Which, you know, and just not cut away, you know, but...
Just Bigsby's are hard to keep in tune and maintain. And
yeah, although I've seen people really with the... on that, they do actually work on those ones if they don't put the strings under the bar.
Yeah,
you go
over,
don't you? Yeah, because an arch top, it works. You just go straight over the bridge, and I've seen people sort of diesel just absolutely hammer his, and it didn't go out as soon. I said, how do you do that? He said, oh, every month the bridge walks up.
Just
give it a bit of a nudge and it'll be right.
Yeah. Conversations. So then I had used to use a Rickenbacker 12 string, or a Burns 12 string with the church and that.
Oh, cool,
sometimes had two 12 strings at once, you know. And I got a Maton one now, which has got the Rickenbacker sound, single pole pickup, and the humbucking one, which I use the humbucking one primarily anyway, actually, for the sound I like on it.
Okay.
So that's a Maton.
Okay.
Which I was really upset about when I got it, because I thought it would have an intonated 12-string bridge, but it hasn't. It's just got a 6-string. And I thought,
oh, really?
And I thought, well, how come the Rickenbackers have got a 12? But they don't either.
Okay.
Only 12-string guitar with the intonated 12 bridge pieces.
Oh, wow, okay.
It's the hockey stick Fender that Jimmy Page used on Stairway to Heaven in the studio, and he only used the double neck because he had two... Life,
yeah.
I've never noticed. Do you reckon his double neck has got intonated 12-piece bridge?
I'm not sure.
For the 12 string?
I don't know.
Because I'm talking out of my hat, but I've looked for 12, you know. So I've actually doctored up my Maton. I sent it back to the factory and they did a bit of doctoring, and then I tweaked it a bit more to get it to work.
Okay.
Not on all of them, only the middle strings, but I'm going to do the other two strings, because you don't have to do the high strings, because they're all the same anyway.
Yeah.
They're double.
True, they're just unison, yeah.
Yeah. So they had to put two bridge pieces on the one screw.
Okay.
And they just, instead of the two bridge pieces being square, they just sawed them off so that
Okay.
Is that one of the Master Sound?
Yeah.
Electrics, yeah.
They're fantastic guitars.
Yeah, they kind of got their own thing going on.
So yeah, they're different.
I borrowed one for a while, and it's not Les Pauly, it's not.
No, I'm very happy with that.
Yeah.
I'd probably even get a six-string one if I needed another guitar, but I don't have much space here. I even inherited a banjo. Don't tell anybody.
Run for the hills.
A banjo.
And yeah, so that's my electric thing. I've got a couple of Taylor acoustics, 6 and 12s, that are fantastic.
Okay.
Taylor sponsored me too, so they gave me the best 6-string. Back before they were really well known, they sent me one from the factory. Every engineer records it and they say that's the best 6-string they've ever heard.
Wow.
Even though it's got cracks in it and everything like that, because I used to leave it at home when I went on tour and come back home and they'd been partying in my flat and there was crap. The whole last thing I had to do, it was like cracked around the whole body.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could see, I was on stage with it and Aaron said, I could see light through your guitar.
Ooh, that's a bad sign. I think I saw that guitar actually. I think you had it. Did Mark Shipton fix that? And
yeah, that was the one.
Because I think I was there and he was saying, oh, that's Peter's guitar. Yeah, he
glued it back together.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think he had one of my guitars at the time too. And then, oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, the Taylor, what they did is they used a 59 Les Paul neck on an acoustic guitar. That was the idea. And I thought,
Well, that makes sense with the feel.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
Huh. Well, okay. I
never knew that. Their necks feel different to every other acoustic.
Well, I went looking for an acoustic guitar and I tried all the Gibsons were all muddy and then all the Martins had a V-neck that I tried.
I
couldn't find any, and, you know.
The historically accurate ones or whatever they call them.
I don't know what it was, but and then every time I played a Taylor, it had an even tone all the way through and every guitar sounded the same. I mean, like, sounded even-toned.
Yeah.
And
the pickup systems are really good too, so you get the best of both worlds.
I don't like any of those pickups. I've heard, you know, the microphone combined with a Piezo pickup can work, but I use hole.
Oh, sound hole pickup. Oh, yeah, okay.
I just do not like that Piezo pickup sound. It sounds like something going spitting out.
Okay.
I don't say what kind of hair. We've all done it. You know you've done it.
Yeah. Shall we say?
You never look
cat
at
hair.
It.
Cat hair.
Yes.
Cat hair. Yes. Yeah. It's cat hair. That's what it is.
Yeah. Mouse hair in Canada.
Mouse hair. All right.
So yeah, it's like a mid-range thing that you just can't EQ out. Those pickups, the undersaddle.
It's the compression thing that.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can describe it. I really don't like it. I've actually plugged my acoustics. One, we did an album called Forget Yourself, which you wouldn't be able to tell, but they're acoustic guitars going through the effects as well.
Yep.
I mean, the analog effects and the digital effects. In fact, the single was like a nylon. I shouldn't tell you, this is really my big secret. A nylon string guitar. Like Willie Nelson plays lead guitar on a nylon string guitar. Right? That the sound of nylon string guitars going through fuzz box is the biggest, filthiest sound. You know, you think the blues guys use those acoustic guitars through amplifiers, right? Those big hollow body acoustics, right?
Yeah.
But a nylon string guitar through fuzz boxes, that's what we did on that track, and you'd never know. Ooh, it.
Got to try that out. So there's a couple of things I got to try out now.
So that's the guitars, the nylon string. Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. I realised that they use banjos on, the Hollies, songs. You know, they had to get that guitar sound. It's probably, I think, pretty sure it was a banjo.
Okay.
Some of the things, you know. So I'm
surprising.
I'm going to mess with the banjo. And I've got a mandolin. A girl gave me her inherited mandolin. It's a Martin mandolin.
Oh, nice.
And that's a beautiful sounding thing. And when you pedal them, they kind of got the same tuning as a violin.
Violin, yeah.
But it's steel and like a 12-string steel style. And when you pedal them, you almost get an orchestral sound without it sounding schlocky like an orchestra.
Okay. I've just got one recent myself. So.
That's why I like my orchestral sound, getting back to the effects. I started with a reverb unit. And under the Milky Way, we had to perform that live and we didn't have a keyboard player. So I used to just strum reverb sounds, which everyone's doing now, like drenching of anywhere. I was just strumming the reverb sound as like a stream sound. And then a guy in a music shop in Byron Bay said, Digitech have got this harmonizer that's got a 12-string setting in it. as I played that, and I said, that sounds really dinky, you know, like the digital whammy things. Yeah. Came out. Yeah. So he tweaked it a little bit, and I said, you know what? If I stick that through the reverb unit, maybe that'll work. And voila, there was like this iconic, fantastic Mellotron guitar sound that was even better than a Mellotron.
The Shimmer reverb. I could, nowadays, I guess it's called. Shimmer.
So
it's the only amateur.
Yeah, so now, well, actually, it's all over the place. Yeah, that's what happened. Ian got his Shimmer reverb Big Sky and got the same sound one day. Yeah. And I thought, oh, why am I lugging around a rack and a spare rack? So, or two racks and two spare racks for this sound when it's in a little pedal.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got that.
Wow.
As well as a spare.
Yeah. So what was in your rack before you...
The Depth 5 and this Digitech. And then as you do, you just start mucking around with all the stuff. And then I started getting down the rabbit hole of sound effects and that. I had to write everything down. Then I've got like a Korg switcher pedal now that has all the settings. And you have to be like a genius to be able to program it anyway. But you just switch it. And I've got three. I ended up with a Sony rack as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which... has like really immense reverbs and things like that.
So did a reverb and a delay and something else maybe as a series of them up?
I've started messing around with lots of those patches and combine a lot of patches. That was the killer, because if you know what the sound is, you know, you can hear it. But if you go and combine them and then put weird instruments and analog things in along with it, you have to replicate it. So are we going to play that song live? So I was really out of it that day. We wrote that song. And I wouldn't know what the sound was in. We're never going to get the sound back. We've lost songs that haven't been able to get...
Oh, really?
Fingering, just the fingering. Haven't been able to figure out the fingering for one song. And it wasn't one of the biggest important things. But I write down the fingering now, all the tabs, and I film it.
Okay, all right. Everything.
Like, and when you're on a roll and writing down tabs and they've got another song they're jamming on, it's time to come on, play along with them. I'm still writing down the last one, you know? And the settings of all of the racks. Sure. And you make mistakes because you're not in the... You're excited.
Because you're rushing. Yeah.
And rushing and, you know, stressed and family problems and things like that around.
That pesky life that gets in the way sometimes.
Yes. That you write songs about to make them pay for
it. That's it, that's it.
You get your own back. Anything that goes wrong in my life, I say, yeah, I'm going to get a song out of you.
So when it comes to songwriting, is it something that you do? You sort of muck around with sounds sounds will then inspire the song?
Absolutely. You generate environments with sound.
Yeah.
I seduced a woman once with this Depth 5... they put headphones on her and headphones on me, and we just went through the patches with a microphone and the no dry sound kind of thing. It was like going out into space, and we just all... She was a musical minded person too. She had a beautiful voice, actually. So we just kind of having fun in the reverb world, you know, like with no dry signal, and it really is environments. That's what music is, sound environments and stuff like that. And
I have to get myself a Depth 5
and some headphones. When you invite the girls out, just put the headphones on. Cool. No,
I seduced her intellectually.
Oh, intellectually, of course. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, there's air quotation marks going on here, folks.
That's what kind of love do you mean?
Intellectual love.
Intellectual love. Well, you know, each their own.
Next to a bookshelf, for instance.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, we are next to a bookshelf.
It's safer.
Much safer. Much safer.
You need a dictionary for protection, let's just say that.
Yeah.
Okay, so these effects. So I've got this pedal board that has got so big now with my analog pedals and 40 years of writing music and church. So I think we've been going 35 years. We've done 25, 26 albums. Plus, you know, so have to get all the sound effects for different songs, because sound effects will generate a song.
That's it,
So you have to have the sound. So I've got so many... Aaron comes on stage and switches all my pedals for me now, because, you know,
you've got to perform.
I've got to drink. But once upon a time, you know, we get to such high, you know, lofty heights, and then I have to look at the set list. Oh, that's that song, and I've got codes
what do I have to do
the
with
song
that
list for the main switching the rack. But then I've got all the other pedals, and I've even got stuff now. I've got a DI that runs clean sounds and or a volume booster, that bass DI. I've got three of them actually.
Yeah.
Got one of them to create tones, you know, that might be a really clean, trebly lead sound on the bass pickup that I can't get unless I go and EQ it with the treble in that DI. Mm. So Aaron has to do all that, and there's no way I was going to get a Boss switch and that. You can't do that. You have to have someone there like going, oh,
which, switched
which, and got these little white marks for each song for these things and
wow, okay.
on or off. And even he forgets. Mm. And I think, what, you know, half the time I go, well, you know, no, and that starts going, oh, I have to, I'm switching myself anyway. You know? But between two of us, we get it right, you know.
Wow, wow, that's a, yeah. Well, like I said,
There's lots of switching going on, and I would like to make it remote, but I can't. I can get the rack and the digital stuff, but
the analog stuff, I guess, yeah, unless you have multiples.
It's on most of the time anyway, the analog stuff, and okay. then I only override anyway. So why would you go and stick that into a switcher?
Yeah,
just for the noise levels and things like that. You know, with buffers and like, I don't know. I bet it all goes back to people just going to get a Les Paul and stick it in a marsh. I'm done with all that. I've thought about that. Except I know it's hard to find a good Les Paul.
Well, that's a thing. Well, I guess you could do the switcher thing, which turns all that on and then also does all the other stuff. But I guess that gets really complicated then.
I'm too stressed to even consider it now. I've been looking online for pedal boards and everything like that. And it's like I've got a plastic pedal case.
Hmm.
With a guitar stand in it, mind you.
The, yeah, yeah, well,
acoustic and three electric guitars mm-hmm. made by Gator cases.
Yeah.
It's light, strong, never breaks. Like we've had bass cases made of aluminium and indestructible stuff, all being destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, and my pedal board made with a plastic case, survive. Never been destroyed. There's bits hanging off it,
yeah.
but it still works. You know?
The airlines
and it's
are...
really light. And yeah, then I've got this one, my rack case, now I've got a sleeve to protect it because it's so valuable, with an outer case. It's the heaviest thing in the
world. Oh, yeah,
yeah.
And it could cost a fortune shipping that, flying that. It and does. That stuff. It's, yeah.
3 kilos of effects and 40 kilos.
40 kilos of case.
Well, two flights and I could buy a Big Sky.
Well, that's it. Well, there you go. Just from lugging all this stuff around. So, is that something you consciously do? Do you go out to like shops, or do you see pedals and you plug them in and you go, you kind of look for something new to inspire you for sounds? No,
not really. Like I went looking for this Roland looper and ended up with the Roland guitar synthesizer
instead.
Cause,
yeah,
because I thought, you know what? I bet I can program that to be an echo.
Okay.
Maybe not a loop, because I was trying to get rid of the Line 6.
Yeah.
And I thought, Matt, I might even be able to get a reverse sound because it's so powerful.
Yeah.
I should be able to get it to do an echo. And I wasn't that mad on a looper anyway.
Yeah.
You know your little Line 6 echo pedal? Does that do the reverse?
Reverse? Thing? The Echo Park, yeah, I think it does.
Yeah, Line 6 did those pedals with the modular...
Which is, I think it's the same as the big green one.
Yeah, I should get that. But there's a new pedal specifically for doing reverse stuff.
Oh, okay.
There's a new reverse. That's the problem. My head's full of stuff looking at pedal board combinations and switches and that. I've been aware of all this other stuff and I'm kind of overwhelmed. I don't even know what brand any of the things that I liked were anymore either.
Okay.
But I go, yeah, it's a matter of... necessity, isn't it? Mother's invention.
Oh, of course.
If you
yeah.
need something, or you get bored, you know.
Yeah.
So, but this guitar synthesizer now,
I've got the blue one, is it?
I'm going to program that into my switcher as well, into my Korg switcher.
Yeah.
Which is okay. It's just an extra. Well, they don't make sense either. The manuals for those, there's three different manuals for things like that, and I use the one that's not the manual that I got with the thing that actually works to work it.
The Boss stuff is renowned to
that
have.
Was Korg.
Oh, the Korg even.
Yeah, the Korg stuff. I know that Boss stuff. I never programmed any of those. They're all presets. I won't do that.
Oh, yeah.
But programming the thing to switch them.
To switch it, yeah. It's...
Well, I'm pretty good. I can program Cubase pianos, you know, the MIDI piano, pedals and everything. I could program, I can do all that. And that's worse than anything, that MIDI madness of program.
No.
And these...
Switches.
You get a win.
Well, we're up to an hour 20.
No,
maybe we should slowly wrap it up.
Well, I think that's it. Pretty much, yeah, that's it.
No, but it's that was awesome. That was really good. Thank you so much, Peter. Thanks for having us, and thanks for doing
reminding me. How I've got to go on tour, and you've just reminded me of all the stress.
The crap you've got to do. Sorry. So
I'm putting a pedal board together tomorrow. And yeah, you have to anticipate your whole future, don't you? Otherwise, you have to pull it all apart again.
Sounds like fun putting a pedal board together tomorrow.
I'm excited about it. Because I've got one pedal board that I've decided not to change, the old plastic one that's analog, that's probably going to come back into fashion anyway. And this whole new one where it's got the switcher on it and everything, that was like just grew like a vine across the ground, little bits and pieces that were never, and Aaron had to kind of like put it all together separately every night. So we're going to put that all in one pedal case, but it's heavier than the original pedal case now.
Yeah,
that's the weirdest thing.
It's trying to downsize and ending up doubling. It's the guitarist way. That's what we do. Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Alex.
Thank you.
What if they call us nerds, you know? We've got the tone to...
Nerds are cool. We're the cool ones. That's what my mum tells me anyway. Coming back into fashion. No, thank you very much, Peter. And, make sure to subscribe to the podcast and all that stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.